Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
It's a great pleasure to be sitting here with this extraordinary cast of brilliant writers who are here to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the death of Shakespeare. Arguably, and I apologize to the great adherents of Cervantes, the greatest of all the great writers. We've asked them each to talk a little bit about a favorite play of theirs. By some wonderful miracle, everyone chose a different play. Simon Sharma is going to talk about Henry V. Daniel Hahn is going to talk about Twelfth Night. Nell Leighton's going to talk about Macbeth. Deborah Levy is going to talk about Hamlet, and Alan Yentob is going to talk about The Merchant of Venice. And if there is any room at the end, I might mention something about my love of Romeo and Juliet. We're also going to ask you to pitch in with questions and comments and enthusiasms towards the end of the session. But may I first thank you for being here, welcome our wonderful panel, and ask, first of all, Simon.
Oh.
To set us off with this great history play, which I understand was the first Shakespeare you ever saw.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act and monarchs to behold a swelling scene. Then would the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars. And I'm running out of memory. Famine, sword, and fire, like hounds leashed. Those, dear friends, were the first words. I was 10 years old. They were the first words of Shakespeare I heard. My father took me to see Richard Burton with the voice of thick honey be Henry V in the season of 1955-1956. But it began with John Neville, who was a great actor, only, I think, now remembered in the world for playing very well Baron von Munchausen. Was that a Terry Gilliam film? Yeah. And Neville and Burton famously exchanged the roles of Iago and Othello, actually, on alternate nights. But Neville it was. I'm 10 years old. The war is still all around us. Half of London was destroyed. My father, Big Arthur, wanted to go into the theater, but his father forced him to go into the family business. So he was determined that I would have Shakespeare as my birthright. So this was really a kind of early bar mitzvah for me, really. There I was, and I had to learn a Henry V speech as the price of being allowed to go and see it. So when I think of another speech, once more to the beach, dear friends, once more, or feel, I remember it in my 10-year-old voice. The first thing I saw then was John Neville come onto the stage with an immense scarlet cape, throw it across the stage, and begin, "Oh, for a muse of fire." And I realized that actually he was talking to us, me in particular, I thought. And that it's a wonderful speech because it's the only place where Shakespeare talks to the groundlings. In that same speech, he says, "But pardon, gentles, all," meaning that actually the groundlings were going to be as good as the gentlemen who are sitting in the galleries or on the stage. And I suddenly, when he said, "Pardon, gentles, all," and talks about actually your imaginary thoughts and what every audience has to do to piece out what they see with their imagination, felt myself back in Southwark in the Globe Theatre in 1599 or 1600. So there was this kind of, you know, river of sensibility that not just the Thames flowing between the war-battered England at that moment. Shakespeare's embrace of everyone and the sheer, bloody, gorgeous music of what I was hearing. And I, you know, 10 years old, I had no trouble with the lingo, the diction at all.
One of the amazing things about the play is that he mixes a concentration on the king with the most fabulous sequence of scenes with Nim, Pistol and Bardolph, yeah, and the ordinary soldiers. And the juxtaposition of those just feeds the whole study of what politics might be.
Well, it's about exactly, Peter, it's about politics as acting. I mean, remember, you know, Shakespeare still from time to time, but had been a full-time actor as well, which is why the kind of the picture that's drawn physically, the reason the very first word in the whole play is O, is because the Globe Theatre is an O, and later in the speech he describes it more exactly as a wooden O. So Henry, in the Crispian Crispian speech and the Harfleur speech, is the biggest kind of ham actor in the Churchillian way, expecting people to respond. But what is one of the most magic scenes is the opposite, and it is in blank verse, I think, it's certainly in blank verse, where the king, the glamorous actor, goes around the camp at night expecting everyone to love him, and whoa, they do not love him. It's a scene between the king and Williams. And Williams is just a kind of bitter grunt, cold and wet, and has no clue what he's doing there, and tells the king that. And Henry is not pleased. So this extraordinary instinct of negotiating between the playhouse of power and actually ordinary human sensibility was amazing. And I think I got that when I was a kid. I just want to say one more thing, since having talked so much, you're almost certainly not going to come back to me. I was so upset about moving to America was I thought I'd be starved of Shakespeare. He means more to me than Beethoven, more to me than the Rolling Stones, more to me than David Bowie, more to me than Dickens, more to me than the Bible. When I know I'm going to die, I'll be really cross at having Shakespeare blotted out.
Can I ask you, of all people, just the one really big question about the fact that the British inheritance, our birthright, is this language and this play and Shakespeare's versions of our history.
Yeah.
Except factually pretty fucking ropey.
Well, except everybody, Richard III, all the people in love with Richard III said Shakespeare, monster, Thomas More, even worse. Of course he didn't have, you know, of course he wasn't a hunchback. It's all Tudor propaganda. And he was this fine, misunderstood prince of tough but fair government. And then we dig the body of Richard III up from the car park. And he's sort of like, he's sort of, you know, kind of a hunchback, you know, of 15th century England. So he doesn't necessarily always, he gets the spirit of the power play right, I think. I mean, you know, the most catastrophically tragic moment in all of Shakespeare, forget even the end of Lear, certainly the end of Hamlet, is the end of Henry IV, part two, is the rejection, which is, I mean, are you nodding or shaking your head?
No, just absolutely.
Yeah, because it is actually, you know he's going to do it very, very quickly. And it is devastating. It's winter in the heart and soul. And it happens, I know thee not, old man, are the most terrifying words Shakespeare ever wrote. So, you know, I think actually one reason we love him so much, everybody on this panel is a bad example of this, but the kind of repressed public, you know, the repressed declamatory life that most English people live. In other words, they live beautifully in a kind of Jane Austen compass of subtlety, understatement, and irony. And Shakespeare makes us as fat as Falstaff in every way, and we love him for that.
But he's absolutely right about that moment at the end of Henry IV, that betrayal. Yeah. You know, of this man who's been his accomplice and his supporter for all this time. It is the man.
Yes, who loved him, who loved him. That's a broken love affair.
If there's anything that's as cruel, or if not, I would say even crueler, might it be fair to say, Danny, that it's the treatment of Malvolio in the play that you've chosen, Twelfth Night?
I think that is probably fair to say, though having chosen Twelfth Night, I now want to talk about Henry V. I suspect that I'm going to, as the evening goes on, go, oh no, Macbeth is now going to be my play. Henry V has that, I mean, as Simon described, it's sort of the great play about the theatre, apart from everything else, with that opening speech which says, we're going to tell you about horses, you're going to have to imagine that you see horses. But what I think is quite interesting about what Simon was saying a moment ago is when you were comparing the Crispin Day speech, the big public speech, with the private walk at night, actually probably the most effective St. Crispin Day speech I've seen in the theatre was a very small and intimate one. Oh. Because one of the things that happens in that speech is he names the people who are sitting around with
him. Oh, yes, he does.
He says, now will our names, familiar in, yes, familiar in their mouths, household words,
Bedford,
Harry
yeah.
the King, Bedford, oh, Exeter, yeah. Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester.
It's
and
a doomed actually, club.
It is.
Yeah.
A happy
yeah.
few, a
yeah.
band of brothers. And he can describe, in fact, it has a very, very small and intimate thing. Twelfth Night, I chose for lots of reasons. Some of them are probably terrible reasons. Twelfth Night, for me, is the most perfect play tonally. It's the one that is exactly the right tone all the way through. The tone shifts perfectly all the way through, which means that it's structurally very, very hard to change. I directed a production at university and tried to cut it, which is a terrible mistake. I cut about maybe 20% of it, odd lines and scenes. And then I read it through, and one by one, I put them all back again. Because all of the funny bits are exactly where you need funny bits, and all of the pointy bits are exactly where you need pointy bits. And it's the absolutely perfect balance of the light and the dark. It's also enormously sophisticated on things like gender. It's very sophisticated in the humor. There's a very kind of, again, a sort of meta-theatrical humor that goes right the way through the play. So there are lots of things about it, particular things to do with the structure and the tone, which I think are extraordinary about it. It's not my favorite play for any of those reasons. It's my favorite play, as these things happen, for entirely personal reasons, rather than analytical or cerebral reasons. It's my favorite play because I went to see a production 14 years ago, I think, and fell in love with it. And it's one of those things that happens. It's a completely intimate thing. It's also a play which is, I think, the best writing about falling in love and being in love that I have ever read. It's a play that is the most, I think, generous-spirited of Shakespeare's plays. Because you see, when we talk about people like Malvolio, who is mocked, and the characters are very cruel to him, and there are lots of characters who are mocked by Shakespeare as well as by the other characters, everybody gets something, everyone is somehow redeemed, everyone is left with, no one is left looking terrible. Even the people who are mocked and who are humiliated by the characters or by the play, they have a moment.
This is true.
This is true about Andrew Aguecheek, this is true about Toby Belch, about Feste, but especially about Malvolio, who doesn't, he doesn't get his justice at the end, but he is left not saying the last line in the play, but saying the line which everybody remembers, because he says, I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you, and then he leaves. And he's left with a certain kind of integrity. So it's my favorite play because I fell in love with this play when I saw a particular production and it suddenly made sense. Because the spirit that pervades it is, I think, a spirit of immense generosity towards the people in it. And it's also, I think, the only one of the comedies, it's one of the funny ones of the comedies, first of all, which is important. But it's, I think, the only one of the comedies that always makes me cry. Absolutely every time. Good productions, bad productions, absolutely flawless.
You don't cry in Tempest when Prospero breaks? Wow, I do.
Tempest not technically a comedy, though, is it?
Well, The Tempest?
Yeah.
I suppose. But it does.
It's got the funny drunk bits.
Now, you have the extraordinary distinction of being one of the very first people to write for Shakespeare's theatre in contemporary times. So when talking about Macbeth, you talk about it with knowledge that none of the rest of us have.
Yeah, I wrote a play for Shakespeare's Globe in 2010 and was the first woman in history to ever do so, which was a very interesting exercise. And I think my knowledge of Shakespeare changed, actually, by doing it. And the reason I've picked Macbeth, as Danny and Simon have said, you know, our reasons are deeply personal. And it is so much part of our culture. And I was 13 years old and living in a 14th century house in England. It was an incredibly old house with walls this thick and a thatched roof, a very heavy thatched roof. And it was an ancient, ancient house with a beaten earth floor. We just had an earth floor, which when we dug up, we found a gold dagger, which had been hidden beneath the earth floor. And it was really a very intense house to live in terms of the sort of atmosphere of the house. And I had been exposed through my own curiosity. My parents were very bohemian and didn't believe in education. We were supposed to find our way through the world. And the times that I did try to work hard at school, my parents just said, I don't know what you're doing. What are you doing? You know, what is the matter with you? You're sitting at a desk doing some homework. What is wrong? You know, teachers are from hell. So I was finding my way through their bookshelves, and I discovered the King James Bible and discovered this magic language, this extraordinary thing which sort of echoed through my body when I read it aloud. And then one day I went into school where I was sort of with all the village kids on the bus. I mean, we were in the campo for sure, we were in the village. So we used to catch the bus into the local school. And my English teacher said, today we're going to begin Shakespeare. And this was actually my very first introduction. Unfortunately, I didn't have your introduction. You know, it was find things for yourself. Be creative, children. She gave us out copies of Macbeth. And she said, right, let's open it. You know, let's have a little look what this thing is. And we started looking at it. And I recognized instantly it was the same language as the King James Bible. The great thing about having parents who don't educate you, I gotta find something good in this, is that you discover things for yourself. And when you find something for yourself like that and you make that comparison and you realize it's an incredibly exciting, enriching moment. And you actually really own it because this is nothing to do with the system of education. This is something I found. So the language chimed and excited me greatly. And then she said, can you go home and learn this speech tonight? She wanted us to learn tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Mm. Creeps in this petty place from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And I learned that speech. But it excited me so much, I could barely say it aloud because it made me shake. It was so beautiful and the language, the rhythms and the music of the language. And then she did something incredibly clever and she took us to see Polanski's version of Macbeth at the Bristol, at a cinema in Bristol. And it was, we were 13 and we weren't allowed to see it. And she took us in. The teacher just said, don't worry about it, we'll take you in. And it was violent and it was sexual and it had blood and it had tits and it had pubic hair. And it was the most amazing evening. And we got back on the coach and we went back to our cow shit village and sort of, I sat in this bedroom with these thick, thick walls and this thatched roof and thought, my God, what was that? And it took me a very long time because obviously I had no education to finally start thinking about writing. And then I started writing plays. And then I was in a situation where I was going to have a go at writing for the Globe. And it's actually incredibly difficult because as playwrights, we are trained to do chamber music. So usually I write a play with five characters, and I can balance those five characters. That's a possibility. Try writing with 23 characters, because to fill the Globe, so the first thing about the Globe is it's a massive stage, and you have to fill it. And you can't fill it with five people having intimate conversations. You need big gestures. You need a lot of stuff going on. And then the other thing that you realize quite quickly is there's no scenery in the Globe. So what you were just saying about, you know, we're going to imagine horses. And there's a moment when you go, oh my God, it's like writing for radio because there are very few pictures. The pictures you see are the actors coming on and speaking. And it's actually the visuals get driven into the language, which is why the language is so exciting. Because when we see contemporary stuff and we see cinema, you don't have that anymore because you have these extraordinary visuals and you actually use less and less language. The more beautiful the visuals. But if you reduce the visuals, it loads it onto the language. It's a different style of performance as well, because if you're just having an intimate conversation where Danny and I are talking, we're lost totally in the globe. So the globe has to be something different and something bigger. The gestures are bigger, everything is bigger.
Isn't it also incredibly inclusive? I mean, the point about the globe...
I was just going to say...
I mean, exactly. It is amazing that now... I, in going to the globe and seeing those productions and seeing actually The Merchant, which I'll talk about in a while, it is extraordinary that the audience are practically participating.
Yes.
And actually, in a sense, arguing about who they believe in or don't believe in, and whether these characters...
So you just pray that they will never be video projection at the Globe. I love video projection. Yeah. You can see it at the Almeida or Dom Hart, it's fine. But it is the opposite
philosophy. You have to be there.
Shakespeare at the Globe, and working at the Globe then demands that the audience actually...
Shouldn't we all remind ourselves also, shouldn't we all remind ourselves that the Globe was demolished 20 years after Shakespeare died, approximately, when the Puritans came and decided that theatre was something that couldn't be tolerated, and people were whipped and scorned for making theatre. Extraordinary, really.
No. The challenge with the Globe, it's quite funny, really. I mean, I had one go at it, and I think you need to do it a couple of times to understand what this thing is of writing for the space. But the great challenge, and what the staff say, you know, these are people who are working in the theatre who are very down to earth, and they say, yeah, but you kept them there through the rain. And that's the challenge. Because, you know, you've got to write a play and keep the groundlings there in the rain. But it does make you see Shakespeare differently, and I haven't even talked about Macbeth, sorry. But Macbeth is the breaking of storytelling, so it's getting away from the Greek unities of time, place, and action. And actually, it's massive storytelling, which excites me structurally very, very much. And I think that story when I was 13, of realizing you can do something this vast but have story that you're engaged with emotionally and intellectually, was so exciting.
I think it's also worth saying that it's obviously no coincidence that this kind of writing comes out of a theatre where you can't do very much visually.
Yeah.
And so there is a reason why we have this amazing description of Ophelia dying in Hamlet, because we can't show Ophelia dying.
Oh, I don't agree. I think that the director, Thomas Ostermeyer, his Hamlet, which is extremely visual, and starts with Hamlet standing by his father's grave, and there's silence in the theater, and he just faints, and then he stands up, and then he faints again. And this is a physical image that threads right all the way through. It's extremely visual, you know.
Deborah, talk more about your love of Hamlet.
Well, I am Hamlet. You know, I probably would have chosen The Tempest and the way that Prospero plays with this island like it's a toy and calls Caliban my thing of darkness. But we need longer for that. And the reason I've chosen Hamlet tonight is because my mother died last year. And this was the play that came back to haunt me. So we know that Greek tragedy is mostly about unhappy families. And Aristotle told us that politics starts in the family. And we see some of this in Hamlet. And what has always intrigued me about Hamlet is that the young folk, Hamlet and Ophelia, they're sad. They're messed up. And the older folk keep telling them to go away, to take their snot and tears somewhere else. And so in the 1990s, I wrote a one-act play called Pushing the Prince into Denmark, which is a conversation between Gertrude and Ophelia. And Ophelia says to Gertrude, well, if you want me to go away, where shall I go? So Hamlet is in mourning clothes. He's grieving for his father. His stepfather says, "No, no, I want the court to be in festive clothes. This we need to move on. We need to celebrate." And so, when we get to that speech, I'm now going to digress. I think about the British psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott, who worked with children, especially after the Second World War when they were evacuated. And the question he asked himself when he was working with children is, what is there to live for? And that seems to me to be Hamlet's question too. While I've been here in Cartagena, obviously I wanted to read Garcia Marquez's reread, Garbo's Love in the Time of Cholera, and he made me laugh because he has the doctor Urbino. In his sleep, he hears the bells ringing in the church, and he says, "Shit, the dead are dying." A very different tone from Hamlet. So that haunting of the play is my haunting too. And just one thing about ghosts. Simon was saying that this is a language that's available to all of us, that we can all embrace. I went to a school in South London. It was a grammar school for working class girls. My friend's parents were dockers. They worked in the docks in the 70s. They were just about to close down, and their mums worked in the biscuit factory across the road. And I will never forget the shyest girl in my school. It was a production of Hamlet, and it was in modern dress, and she was wearing a denim trouser suit with flares, give that speech. And I understood Shakespeare better at that moment than in many other productions I've seen since.
Thank you. Alan. Well, The Merchant of Venice poses problems for a modern audience.
Yeah, it does. I mean, there are many great Shakespeare plays, and we all become immersed in them at different times. Oddly enough, I saw Peter Hall's famous production at the Royal Shakespeare Company at the Henrys. You know, that was my first experience of Shakespeare. I also saw Laurence Olivier play The Merchant. And I would say about The Merchant is that you just said, "I am Hamlet." Many a Jew would say, "Am I Shylock?" Not "am I Hamlet," but "am I Shylock?" Furthermore, I was thinking, I've just made a program of investigating Shylock, really, just all about Shylock. And in Venice, there's been a huge sort of big debate lasting weeks about Shylock. Was he good? Was he bad? Do we love him? Do we hate him? Do we have any sympathy for him? And I called this film in the end, I had two alternative titles. One was called Shylock Is My Name, because for all of us, you know, we all need to think what that means. And the other, I think, is important about an understanding of Shakespeare, which is what I called it in the end was Shylock's Ghost. And I called it Shylock's Ghost because the extraordinary thing about Shakespeare is what Ben Jonson said about him, that Shylock, he said, he was not of any age, but for all time. This is a man who said this only 20 years after Shakespeare's death. He understood that the debate about Shakespeare would go on, but Shakespeare would have a resonance for all time. And the other thing about Shakespeare is that these plays are so complex, so human, so engaging, so understanding of human nature, about betrayal and ambition and love and deceit and all these things, that like all things in all life, you know, everyone has a different view. And so this was why I started to pursue Shylock. First of all, the other thing that's interesting about The Merchant is that Shylock is much despised. I mean, many people will argue, we would have endless arguments, with everyone had a different opinion about Shylock. And in the end, what I think is extraordinary about this character, he doesn't have that many words in Shakespeare, in Merchant of Venice. He's not got as much to say as Hamlet has or others. And he's surrounded by Bassanio and Antonio and his Jewish princess daughter, Jessica. This daughter who, in a sense, is not much talked about in The Merchant, but she betrays him more than anyone. She betrays him more than Antonio or anyone else. She steals his wife's ring. And the unspoken presence is this man is a widower. The one person he understood, probably, who understood him was his wife. And here is this daughter who betrays him and who goes off, who doesn't like this life living in the ghetto. Now, here's another fascinating thing about Shakespeare. We all know that Shakespeare was passionate and absorbed with stories from Italy. I mean, so many of these stories are set in Italy. He never went to Italy. There were no Jews in England in Shakespeare's time. Almost no
there
Jews.
Were.
Very few, though.
Yes, but there were Jews.
They lived in secrecy.
Yeah, but you knew where to find them.
Were you there at the time or what?
Let's not get hung up on this.
The point is, the Jews were already sent off, you know, many years before Shakespeare's time. But there was a ghetto in Venice, the Jewish ghetto, which was 100 years before Shakespeare wrote. And where did Shakespeare get the germ of his story? Remember, Shakespeare was not averse to theft, you know, to stealing a story and then changing it. He got it from a novella written by an Italian from Venice, a Venetian, and that's where the Pound of Flesh story came from. And visiting the ghetto was fascinating, to visit the ghetto, where actually so much was... In Italy, the Venetians were not allowed to keep the moneylenders within Venice, and so they had to create this alternative space because they couldn't do without the Jews. And it's so fascinating that the synagogue in the Jewish ghetto was not designed by the Jews or built by Jews. It was built by Christians because Jews were not allowed to have many of those occupations. So what I would say about The Merchant and about Shylock is so much of what Shylock feels is unsaid. Now, we know that hath not a Jew eyes. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? These are the two famous speeches, or one Portia's speech, the famous Portia's speech about the quality of mercy. And the other is the fact that throughout all this, Shylock is being defensive all the time, defending himself. Much of the time, his anger is not spoken. It's unspoken. Now, talking about the Globe, I saw production, the last production I saw of The Merchant. Many have done it wonderfully. You may have seen some of you, Al Pacino, that's already on the record. Anthony Scher has done it, a man who didn't like or have any sympathy for The Merchant and for this character. I saw it with Jonathan Pryce. And ironically, Jonathan Pryce's daughter was playing his daughter, Jessica, in the play, which added a resonance of which you don't normally get. You know, as I say, Jessica is often forgotten in this story. It's all Bassanio and Antonio. But the fact is that this relationship is absolutely critical. And the fact that he's betrayed not just by Antonio and Bassanio, by the whole system, and by all the Venetians, he's also betrayed by his daughter. And I think there is so much anger in Shylock, so much which is unspoken, and I think that is one of the powerful things about Shakespeare.
One of the things, because there were some Jews in London, and some of the ones who had left were back by this time, I think. Yeah. But we also know that however many there were, the audience knew what it was to be a Jew and they knew what they were supposed to think about them. And what was interesting, what you were saying earlier, Alan, about the experience of the Globe being kind of inclusive, it also means that if you're a groundling, if you're one of the people in the yard, it also means that you collude with things.
Yes.
There was a previous production of The Merchant done by the Globe in 1998, which had one of the most disturbing experiences I've ever had in the theater, which was where, at the very end of the play, Shylock is being punished, and he's having his money and his estate taken from him. And almost in passing, there is a line which says, and he's going to be converted to Christianity. And there was a little cheer from the audience, yes. Just a little cheer, before they realized what it was they were cheering. But one of the things that's extraordinary about that play, but also about a lot of the experiences of seeing things in the Globe, is because of that intensity of that relationship, you find yourself, Iago completely plays on the sympathies of the audience, Richard III completely, they all address the audience, they ask the audience questions. And it was particularly striking with Merchant of Venice, because you found yourself in the audience going, yeah, that's right, convert him to Christianity. Oh, no, wait a second. Could I just say something?
That in this production of the Globe, I don't know if anyone else has seen it, in this production of the Globe, what has happened is that for a lot of people, Shylock is forgotten. The last act of The Merchant of Venice is all about Portia and Bassanio and everyone having... It's a sort of comedy, and it's sort of irrelevant in a way. So whatever's happened to Shylock, he has had all his money has gone, everything has gone. He has been told that he has to convert to Christianity. And rather boldly, and of course you can't ruin Shakespeare because, you know, someone can do it again. Very boldly, the Globe production shows Shylock being converted to Christianity. And it's a very, very shocking scene because there he is sobbing. And of course, that is something which is ignored by a lot of people. It's a terrible, terrible fate that he faces.
Do you know who I'd cast as Shylock is the young Art Garfunkel of Simon and Garfunkel. Because one of the problems of the racism in Shylock is that I suspect, I don't want to presume, that we all think we know what Shylock looks like. We don't know what Hamlet looks like, or Macbeth,
that's true.
Or King Lear. I think we probably imagine that he looks a bit like Fagin.
He looks like him.
Or yeah.
Sorry.
So I would like to see the casting of Shylock just a little bit more complicated, a little bit more subversive.
Can I just make a quick plea for Romeo and Juliet just before opening this to you? There are sort of four things I want to say about it. First is that I have a very personal relationship with it in that there was a wonderful American actor called Sam Wanamaker who employed my father in the 1960s to put up some tents on Bankside and create a Shakespeare season. And none of the British companies would join in because he was American and because it was in a tent and because it was vulgar. And so he brought in lots of international companies. And I was taken at the age of five in 1969 to go and see a Russian production of Romeo and Juliet. And barely speaking English, I had no Russian at all, but was aware that this play combined the most exquisite delight and comedy with the most absolutely hammer-blow, catastrophic ending of any of the plays. And I now know, which I didn't then, that Macbeth leaves you with Macduff and the idea of succession and, Fleance and his... Edgar is standing there having learned what he's learned at the end of Lear. Even Fortinbras can be seen as some kind of movement forward, but at the end of Romeo and Juliet, you've got two stupid old men putting up statues. It's just unbelievably heavy and black. And at the same time, you've got a play that was both extraordinarily subversive. Imagine even then, in a time of religious obsession, building a plot around a friar, and albeit there hadn't been friars for a while in England, but you've got a friar who is A, dabbling in narcotics, and B, thinks that it's a great idea to have someone rise from the grave after 3 days. This is absolutely heretical, blasphemous, dangerous. It's an insane plot. There's a terrible plot hole in the middle of Romeo and Juliet where if you're prepared to marry the girl, why on earth don't you just take her to Mantua with you? And yet, what he does, and this is 1595, he hasn't written any of the great stuff that we've been talking about yet. He hasn't hit that golden magic year of 1599 or the second great year of 1606. He's still finding his feet. He's had a couple of plays that haven't worked, and he hasn't found his voice yet as a playwright. And
the hero that he chooses, the first person in the history of English drama, in the history of the English language, who is given the greatest gift of that blank verse, is given the greatest speeches that have yet been written in our language, is not a king or a duke, he's not an Italian lord, it's a 14-year-old girl, a child, who is given this extraordinary power. Now, actresses, and many of them, I'm sure, would say that he never wrote anything for a woman as good again, or for a man playing a woman or a boy playing a woman. You get to Juliet, you get to Cleopatra, and frankly, all the rest of the parts are a bit disappointing in comparison with what the boys get. But the greatest stuff ever written at the time was given to a 14-year-old girl. Amazing, revolutionary idea. The last thing I just wanted to say about Romeo and Juliet, which is something that I picked up from a very brilliant academic called Abigail Rokeson, was a very sweet observation about how the plays are recorded and what it might mean. The first versions of the plays that we have are the quartos, which are literally folded up into four as it sounds. The first folio, the published versions, which were made up from stage manager's notes and actor's recollections, don't appear until 1623, long after he's dead. But the quartos are quite specific. If you look at the first folio, 1623 version of Romeo and Juliet, and you get to Act 4, there's a bit, as I'm sure you all know, when just before it all goes totally wrong, the nurse and Peter go and look for Romeo and find him in the square, and she says, you have to go and meet the girl at Friar Lawrence's cell, it'll all work out well. In the first folio, the instruction is, enter nurse and Peter. Peter, one of the smallest roles in all of Shakespeare, an irrelevant role in Romeo and Juliet. He gets to do a little bit of introduction of who's coming to a party, and he comes on with the nurse and has about two lines. Except in the quarto version, it says, enter nurse and Will Kemp. Will Kemp was the biggest star in the country.
Burbage and Kemp.
Imagine Robin Williams is suddenly written into the script with two lines. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that Will Kemp was given license to come on and do 20 minutes stand-up in the middle, improvised, make it up, go for it. You've got the stage, I'm letting it rip. At that point, what exactly is the integrity of the text that we might actually have? Whose punctuation is it that appears in the first folio? These plays are rewritten, retalked, reperformed, reinterpreted. There is no complete version. And when they were performed, we can pretty much bet that if people like Will Kemp and Burbage were involved, they were given quite a large part in the creation, which is all I...
Yeah, it's very interesting what you say, and I think you've got to remember, first of all, Shakespeare was an actor, and he was a performer, and many of these plays didn't have his name on them. They were not identified as his until much later. I mean, I don't quite know at what point it happened, but so, in a sense, his presence as... you can imagine that people like Will Kemp and Burbage, but particularly the comedic bits, could well have been improvised and played around with, couldn't they? And, of course, because the folio wasn't published till much, much later, it took quite a long time for that to happen.
Yeah, and also, not all of the cast had the entire play, did they? Yeah. So they would have stripped the play down. Because
it's like how Woody Allen does things today. He doesn't give everybody all the parts.
Yeah, so you don't get all of it. So that what they then did was they pieced it together after. So yeah. You'd have, 10 of the actors coming in, well, I've
good
forgotten
point.
My script,
yeah.
I've forgotten my script, I haven't got my script. But I remember how that line went. Yeah, I mean, it's, they're very alive. They feel very alive. And I think what's so incredible, that it's sort of hard to describe, it's hard to imagine another writer that you can play with so much.
Yeah.
And as you say, you can do no damage. I really am a big fan for people cutting it up, playing with it.
Yeah.
I think one of the amazing things I saw, I think it was 2 years ago, at the Globe, where they did a Globe to Globe, and they had an entire year of theatre companies from all over the world performing their versions of Shakespeare at the Globe. And it was the most
Yes,
fantastic
it was to do with the
experience.
Cultural, it was the Cultural Olympics.
Oh, it was a cultural
it was
Olympics,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
The
so
number of productions, the variations, Korean versions,
yeah.
That
and
was
I
amazing.
Saw, I saw a hip
pop version from Chicago, I think it was,
yeah.
of Othello. And it lasted 60 minutes. And it was just fantastic. And then you can go and see another version of Othello. But it's hard to imagine another writer in the world. You know, we were looking at Cervantes for this thing Deborah and I are talking about tomorrow. And it's just the sheer amount of work, actually.
Yes, the opposite from Beckett. You can't imagine Beckett being so experimental, which he is. But my God, if you change one word of Godot or Happy Days, the whole thing completely collapses.
Just back to Romeo and Juliet. What I really love about that play is that it's not called Romeo. So Juliet gets an equal billing with Romeo. Antony and Cleopatra, so we have a double billing there.
Are you saying that Shakespeare was a feminist?
No, Shakespeare wanted to topple the patriarchy, and so he added Juliet and
Cressida
and Cleopatra.
Cleopatra's an amazing role.
And Viola, you know, there are really great women parts.
There are actually, and it's something like. I heard the proportion, it was something like 30% of the lines are women's lines. It was actually a lot more than I thought when someone said it the other day, whoever works these things out.
Beatrice in Much Ado is a fully realised...
Absolutely right.
I hope my women friends here agree. Fully realised, powerful...
And she gets the punchlines as well at the end of the play.
Yeah, she has all the good jokes.
She's the great presence in that.
And now, what I wanted to say about Macbeth... is that when Lady Macbeth has that line, I would pluck my child from the boneless from my nipple and dash the brains out if I had sworn to do that. Yeah. Where Shakespeare is so brilliant is that if we believed that, there would be no play. So that's a sort of lovely trick that that he turns around.
Absolutely.
Thank you all very much indeed. We have time for questions, if you would ask them. And I think there are roving microphones that will come and amplify whatever you might want to say. Would anybody like to start? Oh, you would.
Well, you were talking, you all talked about these adaptations. This has a weird sound. These adaptations that are part of the afterlife that this already cliche thing to say of the timelessness of William Shakespeare by now, how you related to those performances and how they changed your life. So regarding that point and taking into account this maximum by Marshall McLuhan of medium being the message and how somehow those adaptations are a work co-written by both authors, William Shakespeare and the new director of this adaptation, being cinema, being theater, being a TV show, being whatever you like. How do you see this afterlife now and for the future generations in using this new media? For example, I have a Twitter account and I follow William Shakespeare on Twitter. How do you see that working up for the future generations? How do you see them reading William Shakespeare in the future?
One thing I will say, which isn't exactly an answer to the question, but is an addition to the question, is part of the afterlife of Shakespeare is happening in lots and lots of different languages. And most people in the world who experience Shakespeare with none of his words at all. And so one of the things we have to think about when we talk about the way Shakespeare has survived for 400 years, not just the qualities that make him kind of resilient in the way Nell was describing, but also the fact that when you say that he's reinterpreted by directors and by film directors and by all different kinds of people, we're also talking about, I say this as a translator and therefore someone who is slightly, you know, partisan on this issue, but we're also talking about 400 years of people who have themselves recreated Shakespeare
for people who only speak Spanish or people who only speak Italian or people who only speak Polish. So one of the things that's happened in these 400 years is Shakespeare has been sort of reborn, but with, I mean, it's funny because when we talk about Shakespeare, we always end up talking about language, and actually most people experience Shakespeare without any of it.
Yeah.
Because someone else has produced a new piece of language, which is always going to do different things. And like those directors you talked about, and like the film directors you talked about, all of these translators who are rewriting Shakespeare are doing something interpretative, creative and interpretative and expressive, not just, you know, putting it through a machine. So one of the really important parts, I think, about thinking about how someone like Shakespeare survives and spreads is actually to think about what happens to the language, what happens to the plays when you take all of the words out, and yet we all somehow have Hamlet or Macbeth or whatever it is, even without any of the words. I mean, it's a very odd thing.
It's a possibility. Well, it is odd, but if you think about Greek tragedy, actually, which, I mean, how many people have seen, Sophocles, for example, very unlikely to have, and yet, you know, there is something irreducible at the core which makes it possible to actually survive and flourish organically in other languages.
One of the other things, just to sort of counter or complement Danny's point, is that for anybody who is lucky enough to be born speaking English, he's in everything we do. I mean, not one of us gets through a day without a quotation or an improvisation around or a reference or a citation of something that he probably invented. I mean, this is a man who invented more words than any other three writers put together in the English language and created phraseology and idiom that is passed down onto the streets of LA now just as much as they are onto the boulevards of Stratford-upon-Avon.
It is absolutely true that if you look up the colloquialisms that we take for granted today in our language, in fact, people have now, because it's the 400th anniversary, lots of people are coming up with them. Phrases which feel so immediate of today, and actually, lo and behold, they came from Shakespeare. Somehow or other, they found their ways. So these are words and language which was, he didn't have, you'd be surprised, no Google and Wikipedia. So Shakespeare, these words and this language which he captured were, I don't suppose they were invented, they were colloquial, but they weren't around the place. And he brought them into being, along with the iambic pentameter and blank verse and all the rest of it. It's extraordinary, that mix.
So we have time for one last question, and I'm sorry we've two.
Good evening. Guys, I have a question for all of you, of anyone who wants to answer it. Do you think that in a violent time we're living in, where everywhere in the world there's crime, there are attacks, terrorist attacks, do you think that Shakespeare's plays like, for example, The Tempest, or Macbeth, Hamlet, or The Merchant of Venice can be used to think our today's otherness?
Wow. Okay. Out the ball, Nell, it's all yours.
I couldn't quite hear the question. The sound was just straight. To do with terrorism.
It's due, in a violent world, what have these plays got?
Oh, I think I can absolutely answer this. So a friend of mine, Jessica Swale, who's also written for The Globe, who directed my play for The Globe, went to Bosnia, and she took into a very recent war zone a Shakespeare play, and she did a massive project, cross-cultural project, Shakespeare project. And she also went to the Marshall Islands, and she did an amazing project there with the same organization. And she said it was so effective, because it's very difficult to deny the humanity that are in the plays. And yeah, the language has changed, but the humanity and the stories are still there. And the thing is, there was a huge piece of research very recently that said how ancient all of our stories are, and that they're all going back to one thread. And the one thing that we all understand from throughout our entire lives is stories. And if you can frame the experience of a country but in somebody else's story. And it's universal, you know, these are universal stories. And if you can frame it in somebody else's language, which is from such a long time ago, it's actually a great way of doing it. And culture has a huge part to play, a massive part to play in all of the countries where there is terrorism and major problems. And theatre people relish this. You know, theatre people are traditionally very liberal, very open, love working with it. So Shakespeare is perfect, absolutely perfect.
But you're talking
about... I mean, I saw, it's not quite terrorism, but I mean, one of the most incredible experiences was actually seeing kids from very tough drug gang terrorized communities of Washington, D.C. This is about 15 years ago. Each school was actually given an act of, I mean, it is self-evidently obviously going to be Romeo and Juliet, but I'm not sure they'd seen West Side Story or anything. And they were all minority students, Latinos, but mostly black. And they not only had no trouble with the language whatsoever, they were living actually that mad threshold of testosterone-driven violence combined with a kind of ecstatic sentimentality of the Romeo-Juliet moment. It was as if it had been written for
anyone,
them.
I think this is really interesting. The world we now inhabit, you know, you'd think it was a long way away from Shakespeare's world. We're living in a world of ISIS, of Donald Trump, of the favelas in Rio, of things you're talking about, of Vladimir Putin. These extraordinary characters, these the brutality, not just the humanity and brutality, it's just as evident today in a way. And oddly enough, in the last 10 years, you can't get away from it because of communications, because we're all obliged to share these stories, you know. And I think Shakespeare is more resonant today, perhaps, than he was 20 years ago.
I mean, every single bit, you know, the world comes back to Shakespeare. If you think about hideous Angelo in Measure for Measure and the hypocrisy of sexual sanctimoniousness,
Yeah.
I mean, every single play will actually give us a sense of...
Or his honesty about sexuality. Look at Bassanio and Antonio and all that stuff, which is all there, hidden away, and was all happening anyway.
I think another point, going back to the question, which is really interesting, is that it stretches people. This is the thing, isn't it, about Shakespeare? It's layered. It's like an onion. And you can just go down and down and down. You know, we were talking earlier and just saying, these extraordinary layers of meaning that are in Shakespeare. So what you do is you get marginalized people and you say, yeah, I know you're intelligent. I know that you understand this. You have a sensibility. And I think that there's something magical. So, you know, what you said, Simon, of course, these kids are completely stretched by it. And so much of the time, we don't think people are intelligent enough. We don't give them really meaty stuff, and I think it really works. And Shakespeare's just so elastic.
Well, not what we give them, I promise. I speak from the United States now, and I'm nothing against, not a lot against, To Kill a Mockingbird, even what we know. What you get in literature class in schools is civic improvement, actually, and what is sucked out of it is the oxygen of malice, violence, desire, greed. In other words, all the things that make humans human.
But well said.
Question, last question from there.
Hi, and it's been a pleasure to hear you. I just want to share my experience of Shakespeare. I am a Colombian, 100%, and I was in Boston learning English long time ago now. And I went to a play, and I sat there for a long time, and when I came out, I understood that I had learned English. It was a before and after, because I understood the language, and because I understood the feelings, very human feelings that were there. So, this has been very interesting, especially when you always come back to language. But when you have a second language, as it is English, it is different how you understand it. But when it comes down to feelings, that's when you understand the language fully. So thank you very much for that enlightenment. and I understand even more Shakespeare. And on Cervantes, being the 400 years of both, Cervantes also is a wonderful man that his language also parallels Shakespeare, but on another light, probably, on the good man. He and the Quixote kind of sort of tells us what a good man is.
Thank you. Thank you, and thank you all very much indeed. Thank you.